The J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, you were otherwise occupied on Sunday, as we'll get to very shortly. But a wild weekend in the top flight with upsets galore. The J-League never fails to surprise us, does it?
Yep, you never know what's going on in this league. You think you have it sus 1 minute, and then Yokohama FC get their first away victory in 17 games. So yeah, it's always a fantastic league, and yeah, a load of terrific games this weekend.
Indeed. And we'll also get to the highs and lows of Sam's Sunday after we welcome in our guest. Johnny Nicol is becoming a part of the furniture here, which we very much enjoy. Johnny, you're also licking your wounds after some late disappointment, but it's great to have you back with us. Welcome back to the pod, and how are you?
Thanks very much, Ben. I'm doing a bit better than Sam. I've had an extra day to recover from my disappointment, but it seems like it's been a month since I've been on last, and there's been an avalanche of football all over the place, so it's good to get our teeth stuck into it and maybe forget my disappointment a little.
Okay, then. All right. So, we'll wrap up the ACL group stage that Johnny is referring to there before we dive in on the weekend's J1 games. But firstly then, Sam, our listeners will remember you were at the England versus Germany Euro 2020 quarter final, and I don't know how you managed it, but you also got in to the final at Wembley. Can you confirm through legal means you weren't one of those who jumped the gates, were you?
No, I was not trampling over people and punching people and getting my way through into the stadium. Yeah, I got very lucky on Saturday where they released a small section of tickets about there, and we had all hands on deck to try and get tickets, and one of us managed it. So yeah, I was very lucky and privileged to go and watch my team play in a European Championship final. It was a pretty incredible experience. The game didn't quite go our way, but yeah, the rest of the day, bar a few incidents in and outside the ground, but other than that, yeah, it was fantastic. But yeah, fair play to Italy.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine what sort of a day it was for you. I mean, Luke Shaw's early goal, Jordan Pickford's save in the penalty shootout to give England the advantage. They both must have been just about the highest highs you've had as a football supporter. I mean, ultimately, as you say, it's ended in tears for the Three Lions. But yeah, what a footballing experience for you.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredible. You can't really put into words like the pandemonium when Shaw scored after 2 minutes, and you think, oh, it's definitely going our way. And then, yeah, it all kind of sagged for the rest of the game. But then you get that high of the Pickford save from Jorginho, and you just think, OK, Jorginho is missing a penalty. It's definitely going for us. But, yeah, dragged back to earth pretty sharply by a couple of penalty misses. But I thought, yeah, Italy, I think, were the better team on the day, but the England team, I thought, were fantastic throughout the tournament. They conduct themselves much better than any other England team I can imagine. I think Southgate is a terrific human being, first and foremost, and he's done wonders for us. So, yeah, I can't say anything negative about at least the players on the pitch. You just kind of gloss over various England supporters off the field.
All right, that's very well said, Sam. And, yeah, commiserations to you and all England supporters. But, of course, yeah, on the flip side, congratulations to Cesare Polenghi, to Gabriele Anello, and to all of our Italian listeners, everybody who was pulling for Italy on Sunday. A terrific achievement for them and, yeah, as Sam says, a well-deserved Euro 2020 title. Okay, then, returning closer to home, although I guess Uzbekistan is not that much closer to Japan than Wembley. The ACL group stage wrapped up over the weekend, and Johnny, we knew at the time of recording last week that your Gumba Osaka side had a mountain to climb to reach the round of 16, but they thumped Tampines Rovers 8-1 in midweek and pushed group winners Junbuk all the way in your final game. Into the last 5 minutes, a goal would have sent you through to the knockout stage, but Junbuk played party poopers and won it in the 88th minute. Ultimately, a very cruel way to go out.
Yeah, I think when I got up after getting a few hours of sleep on Sunday morning, I read a comment from Patrick, who got 6 goals in 6 games. He can obviously hold his head up high. And he said, like, we got the equaliser and we had the game under control. But I think the key quote was, we couldn't get a second goal. It almost feels like that could be the kind of tagline for Gamba's ACL campaign. We couldn't get a second goal. Which I guess earlier in the season after the COVID break, we couldn't get a goal. So we've made some kind of progress. I think Jumbuk, like, because Gamba, I want to say destroyed, but Gamba, in the first game between the two teams, Gamba had more shots and goal in the first half than they've been averaging over 90 minutes in J1. And then the second game, I was trying to think of the most diplomatic way to describe the penalty Jumbuk got after 5 minutes. I think to unite everyone listening, I might say you'd be annoyed if it was given against your side. And it was always going to be an uphill struggle after that. Gamba, they came out firing at the start of the second half, and I think a couple of good chances, and then Patrick finally got the goal, and then they just couldn't kick on. Jumbuk are a very difficult team to kind of rate because they almost remind me of the Italian national team, in that they have a lot of very good technical players, but they don't necessarily play a particularly expansive style of football, but it's very effective. So they'll be a tough team for anyone to face. If I was to put a positive spin on it from a Gamba perspective, with our situation being so many games back, we don't really need quarterfinals, semifinals of the Champions League, even if it was going to be against Cerezo. So I'm disappointed in some ways, but in other ways, you might want to take a go at the opposition Gamba have faced, but in the last 10 games, that defeat to Jungbuk is the only defeat, and we've scored 9 times out of 10, so we're slowly but surely kind of getting back to some kind of form, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask, really, I mean, given like the situation Gamba are in the league, have you seen positives in the performances in these games that can say we can go on and get ourselves out of relegation and maybe push on into mid-table? Or do you still think there are some concerns if you're not being able to put Shangri United away, for instance?
It's quite a difficult question, Sam, because in terms of performances, the way Gamba have controlled games and knocked the ball about, and especially that first game against Jumbo could almost become, it almost became a kind of noose round Matsunami's neck, in that Gamba have been very sideways with their passing in J-League, but against Jumbo it was very direct, very straight towards the goal. They were getting in behind the fullbacks constantly, and it was very interesting to see, especially after the second Shangri game, because usually when the Japanese Gamba fans or Japanese football fans in general kind of comment, it's usually they put a positive spin on things, like, we didn't get the result we wanted, but let's keep fighting. You'll definitely do it next time. There was a lot of negative comments after that second Shangri game. The first game, Gamba dominated, but they just got stung. They didn't get the second goal. They got stung. The second game was poor. And you know, Shangri were, I don't want to say the better team, but Gamba didn't deserve to win that second game. So fans have seen what Gamba can do, what this group of players can do. They've also seen that there's a lack of consistency. If this ACL shows one thing, is that draws are not Gamba's friend when they come back to J1. I think they've got 12 games between now and the end of August. I think if they were to win 6 and lose 6, I would happily take that, because that would put them like 32 points from 27 games out the relegation zone. Like, I'm not even expecting top half, but just I think that before I come on to talk about it later, Gamba play Fukuoka this Saturday. I think that's a very important game, because if Gamba were to take 3 points from that, then they're already up to 17th, and they're like, I think, 6 games in hand in Tokushima. So one more win in those 6 games, they're out the relegation zone. So the first 1-2 games in this kind of run, I think, is going to be very, very crucial for morale and kind of building on the positive aspects we did see over in Uzbekistan.
All right. So, yeah, you mentioned Patrick's goals. Johnny, who are some of the other standout players from Gamba's ACL campaign that, still new coach, obviously, Masanobu Matsunami might be relying on, maybe over some of the more established names under Tsuneyasu Miyamoto? Do you feel that Matsunami really wants to put his own stamp on things by getting some of his favourites in? Or, were there any other standout performers for Gamba over in Uzbekistan?
Well, Kohei Okuno, who's a young central midfielder, is broken through. He seems to be a real kind of favourite of Matsunami, and I think he's now the way, obviously there's a lot of rotation for Gamba and other teams, but he seemed to form the strongest, like, 18 midfield alongside Ediguchi. He's someone, if you watch the game, if you're just kind of watching it passively, you won't notice him a lot, but he's a very tidy player, just kind of, like, kind of keeps the game ticking over, passing, picking up from defenders, threading on to the more technically astute players. One player who may have caught the eye from people just watching the highlights would be, like, Shuhei Kawasaki. Mm. What I would caution about him is he had a great game against Tampines, but and he was excellent for Gamba's under-23s and J3. But if I was to be brutally honest about Tampines, I think they might struggle in J3, to be honest. So we know Kawasaki can do it against that level of player. He hasn't shown it yet in J1, but he did, when he came on briefly at the end of the Jumbrook game, he did look to kind of attack them, which was the only option at that point. But they would definitely be the two positives. As a negative, I actually meant to mention earlier, Gamba, I don't know how we keep doing this. We managed to get 5 players injured in 6 games. And 4 of those players, Fujiharu, Ono, Fukuda and Takao, had just come back from injury. Obviously, the transfer summer transfer window is going to open in 4 days, I think. I suspect we might see 2, 3, maybe even 4 players coming in. I don't have any names, but especially in the fullback positions or wingback positions and maybe a kind of attacking midfielder. But yeah, there's definitely reasons to be cheerful. Kim Young-won's back as well. Patrick's in form. Usami played very well in the second game against Jumbrook. So yeah, you can pick your poison in a sense. You can pick out the good points. You can pick out the bad points. So hopefully I've managed to give a bit of balance there.
Yeah, you talk about new signings there. Wellington Silva was one of like the big signings over in the winter and finally came in. What did you make of his performances when given a chance in these games? Has he shown enough to you that thinks, yeah, he could be a big player going into the second half of the season?
I think, you know, Sam, because we've both been involved, obviously, in the kind of transfer market, like valuations of players, and that was one of the big debates, is how to evaluate players who've come into Japan this year in various states of fitness and quarantine. So Silva very much falls into that category. He's not been given a full chance yet. I mean, yeah, he scored against Kwansei Gakuin University and Tampines Rovers. He's shown in flickers and flashes. He's got something a bit different, kind of direct running. And I think it was the Yokohama FC game, again, an example of a team that's not particularly great defensively. He did show signs of building a combination with Leandro Pereira. It's still too early to judge with him, but yeah, again, we're going to need all the players we can get in this kind of next 2 or 3 month spell, and hopefully, yeah, the more time he gets in the team, the kind of quality he's shown. I think you said you talked to your kind of colleagues at Football Radar, and he was someone who they thought would do a good job in the J League. It might not be this year, but hopefully in future years, Gamba fans will see the best of him.
All right, and well, I wager we'll see quite a bit of him in the next 3 weeks or so, Johnny, because, you know, my maths isn't fantastic, but I make it, as you mentioned, it's Fukuoka away this Saturday, and yeah, according to my calculations, that starts a run of 8 league games in 23 days. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that runs up until the restart of the entire league after the Olympic break, so... to say that is grueling under very testing conditions now with the summer well and truly up and running and the humidity turned up to 11 will be, yeah, a massive test for your side. And, I think you mentioned briefly earlier about your expectations, but, yeah, Matsunami's really going to have to make full use of his squad in this very, very testing set of fixtures to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, I know Matsunami's kind of, I don't even know what he is, a temporary manager caretaker. It was very, very vague how he's appointed. It wasn't met with universal acclaim. I think Alan Gibson was quite a vocal kind of critic of maybe the job he'd been doing behind the scenes. It's difficult to know what really goes on, how much is him making a difference, how much is other people. But yeah, at least he knows the setup inside out. He knows a lot of the younger players, their qualities, where they can play. One kind of interesting side point, and again, I don't have any kind of like definitive knowledge, but there's a very popular former Gamba Osaka coach who may or may not have coached Japan at the last World Cup, who might be out of work soon. And again, there's nothing concrete here, but some Gamba fans have been talking about how quickly they gave up the chase for Go Oyewa. So I don't know if Mr. Nishino, he might be a popular choice to come in if Matsunami's not quite up to the task. I mean, I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing this out. But Sam, what would you make if that kind of decision was taken by Gamba?
Well, as I mentioned right at the start, Matsunami, I was not delighted with the decision to continue to keep him on. And, I mean, most of Nishino's time in the J-League was before my time of watching it, so I don't really have too much to say on that. But I thought the way he managed to come into the Japan at that World Cup in quite difficult circumstances, but kind of being thrust upon him, I thought he took that job on very well, and he got Japan playing, got them out of the group. They were like a few seconds away from taking Belgium to extra time. So I'm not against that as an appointment. I think, just as long, a bit of a technical nous is what is kind of needed at Gamba, and a little bit, just because the players are there. You've got so much quality in that squad. You've got to think that anyone who kind of has a bit about them could get a lot more out of this team. So I wouldn't be against an appointment of Nishino. I mean, to be honest, anyone but Matsunami is how I'm thinking of it. But yeah, it would be an interesting one. You could see that it's not quite gone his way with Thailand. I think they got a little bit unfortunate in that last set of qualifying where Chanatip wasn't available and Tiraton wasn't there. So they lost on some of their better players. So yeah, if he does become available, if I was Gamba, I'd definitely be sniffing around him.
Interesting one, Johnny. From my personal experience, I would say that you should never go back with Hiroshi Jofuku as the prime example for any FC Tokyo supporters that are listening. They'll well and truly know that it didn't work out a second time round for Jofuku. But Nishino, if he's still got an itch to scratch in the J-League, then Gamba could certainly do far worse. He's a proven winner in this league, and would definitely be an interesting reappointment if he were to return to the club. All right, so we'll quickly round up the rest of the news from the ACL then. So unfortunately Gamba have exited at the group stage, but it's better news for Cerezo Osaka over in Thailand. They sealed top spot in their group last midweek and have lined up one of three J-League versus K-League round of 16 ties in mid-September. Cerezo will face Pohang, who were runners-up in Nagoya's group. Grampus will take on Daegu, who finished second behind Kawasaki in Group I, while at Frontale, a perfect 6-from-6 in their group, have drawn the short straw and must face Ulsan. I'm sure Ulsan supporters will be saying they've drawn the short straw as well. Ulsan themselves went a perfect 6-from-6 in Group F. So I'm not exactly sure how they worked it out, Sam, but that does seem harsh on both of those teams, the only two teams to be perfect 6 wins from 6 in their groups. And, I mean, that tie instantly looks the pick of the fixtures in the East Zone round of 16.
Yeah, it does seem an issue with the format that you get two unbeaten sides suddenly meet each other in the last 16. It's all kind of worked out on which teams that are the best second places from which group, and then it works itself out that way. So both teams have got really unfortunate. I would suggest, maybe if when you're ranking the second place teams, why not just rank the first place teams as well and get a proper order that way? And because it looks like the best two teams are facing each other, and then when you get Cerezo and Pohang, who kind of squeaked through more so than anything else. So I don't think Cerezo played particularly well in their group, but did just enough. But they're playing each other, so it's a weird format. I don't ever like it where you're just based on runners-up and who were the best runners-up and all that sort of thing. But it has thrown up four very interesting ties that I can't call. Ulsan versus Kawasaki. Nagoya, I thought, were very impressive in their group, but they faced Daegu, who gave Kawasaki two good games, and they were without probably three of their best players who were already training with the Olympic team for Korea, so that's a really good tie. And then Cerezo Pohang, again, can't call that one. So I don't think that Nagoya and Cerezo will be too disappointed with what they've got, but Kawasaki facing Ulsan, it's just, it's mouthwatering. It's worthy of a final more so than a last 16 tie.
Yeah, most definitely. And once again, those ties will be played in the middle of September and are one-legged affairs, one-legged knockout ties. But one man who will not be taking part in the knockout stages of the ACL is Kawasaki sensation Kaoru Mitoma, who looks set to follow Ao Tanaka and previously Hidemasa Morita away from Todoroki, with the English Premier League team at Brighton set to sign the dashing winger and then, due to work permit issues, send him on loan to newly promoted Belgian side USG. Johnny, our Patreon-only line group was split on the merits of the loan over the weekend, but it does appear the time is right for Mitoma to move, as much as it might pain Neil Debnam, of course. What are your thoughts on it, and how much it might affect Frontale?
I think, first of all, congratulations to Kaoru Mitoma. He's been excellent the kind of 18 months he's been at Kawasaki. He's a fully fledged professional. Well, obviously, the Cats long since got out the bag regarding the kind of technical qualities of Japanese players and players who perform well in the G League. So a lot of smart European sides are recruiting them. Brighton's obviously a kind of intriguing prospect that they recruit pretty well for a club of their size. And obviously the British kind of visa laws are quite strict, so it's difficult to get them into the country. I don't really follow the Belgian league a lot, but I know players, for example, like Yuma Suzuki's gone there and done well. So I guess it might be the case of if he does well at the team, I'm quite happy you didn't pronounce either, because I'm not sure, Gilles, or I'm not sure how to say it. I think it might be a kind of one and done there, and then maybe go on to the Eredivisie or something and move on up. It's always a kind of question mark, like how well someone will settle over in Europe, but he obviously has the technical ability, the skills and more to do a good job, and I'm pretty confident he will do. I guess you would agree with that, Sam.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I would, if he was able to visa-wise, I think he could go into that Brighton team and do quite well. It's never easy, I don't think, as just the first landing strip to go into the Premier League as a Japanese player. But Brighton are a team that they play very, like, as you, if people would say, football the right way, in quotation marks. They play very, yeah, it's, it, they were kind of roundly mocked for most of last season for just creating so many chances but not scoring goals. So they do play a way that would suit Mitoma, and I think. But the problem I have is the loan move, because it's just one of Brighton's feeder clubs. I'm not going to pronounce it. Saint-Gilloise. Let's go with that. But they're a newly promoted team. They play in a kind of 3-6-1, 3-5-2 formation. So there's no actual winger position. So if you're going to put Mitoma, he's going to have to play left wing back in a team you imagine are going to be very defensive, as they're just coming into the league for the first time in like 40 years. And it just doesn't seem to suit him. I know why they've done it, because in the Pandora's box that is the visa situation post-Brexit, Belgium is quite highly rated as a league, so if he plays 90% of the minutes sort of available in that league, then it gives him a very good chance of finally getting his work permit and joining Brighton. But as for his development at that team, I think there are plenty of better options, even within Belgium, for him to go. I just have to hope that they kind of adjust to him and allow him to play in the manner that he wants to. But yeah, it's a little disappointing to see him there, but if it does work out for him, I'd be very delighted to get myself a Brighton shirt with Mitoma on the back.
Yes, of course, the Premier League club of Barry Velder, long-time a friend of J-Talk and a very regular guest back in our early days, who has since returned to the UK and, loves his seagull. So I'm sure he says he doesn't follow the J-League all that much these days, Barry, but, I'm sure once he's up to speed on Mitoma, he'll be very excited about his eventual arrival. So, Sam, sorry, I know you're not a visa law expert, but is there any chance of him getting the necessary paperwork in the middle, say, of the next European season, or would he have to play one full season in Belgium or elsewhere to qualify for his work permit, and that would see him start playing for Brighton in the 22-23 season, I guess it would be, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure anyone is an expert on these rules, because they're very new, and I don't think anyone's a clue what's going on. But by the looks of it, it's set in yearly blocks, so it'll have to be a full year that he has in Belgium to accumulate the points necessary to go forward, because at the moment I don't think he has a lot there. He might have a couple for playing in the Asian Champions League, and he might have a little bit for playing for the Olympic team, but yeah, it's not really enough at the moment. So he will need that full year in Belgium to give him a chance to go on. But I think if he is a regular playing in that league, then I don't think it will be an issue next season for him to get a work permit. And I don't mind having a full year to acclimatise a little bit. The Belgian League isn't quite the same as the Premier League, but it's definitely a bit closer than the J-League is. So I'm happy for him to get that year, but yeah, just I wish it was a slightly different club.
Right, fair enough then. So, what of Frontale then? We've just seen over the weekend Yokohama F. Marinos win again for the sixth straight league game, and close to within 9 points of Frontale, still with a game in hand. We'd been saying for the past few weeks, Sam, that we wanted a proper title race. It looks like Yokohama F. Marinos are going to keep up their end of the bargain. And the fact that, Frontale have lost Ao Tanaka and now Mitoma in the in the space of a month or 6 weeks, really, I guess, throws things pretty much wide open, doesn't it? When you add in the fact that they'd lost Morita in the last off season, of course, replaced him with Jao Schmidt, who has fitted in extremely well. But that's now three key members of last season's championship-winning side who will now be away from the club. And we know they do have a lot of good youngsters coming through, but this is surely going to test their system to its absolute limit.
Yeah, it's going to be really difficult for them. I mean, they do have some money coming in for these two signings, but it's kind of difficult to see what they're able to do with it. I mean, they could look for foreign players, but there's no guarantee when they're going to get into the country. So you'd imagine they'd have to look from within the J-League. I think Red stole a march on them in getting Atoro Osaka, because I thought he could have been an interesting one that they could have picked up. So, yeah, I mean, to lose the two players that they have, I mean, it's going to hurt any team. At least in midfield, they have Oshima. If they could keep him fit for half the season, then it might plug that gap with Tanaka, and Hasegawa is not a bad left winger. They've got a fairly deep squad, but it's not that deep. So I think they will be looking for one or two players. Someone could rescue Yusuke Matsuo from whatever's going on with him at Yokohama FC, and maybe that would be an interesting kind of way just to get through this season. But yeah, I've said from a lot of this season, which is almost certainly coming back to bite me now, but I can't see Yokohama catching them up, but I definitely can now. I mean, they're still a very good team there at Kawasaki, but to take two of the best players in the league out of them, it's going to really, really stretch them, especially as the fixtures are going to pile up a little bit for them as well. So, yeah, it's great for the rest of the league if you want a title challenge, but it's a really difficult situation now for Kawasaki. But their recruitment has generally been very good, so maybe they'll pick a couple of gems out.
One of the players I was actually going to say, it's interesting, Sam, you mentioned players that Kawasaki could sign. Yuta Higuchi from Sagan Tosu, I think he's someone who might fit in quite well with the kind of players that Frontale have. And I agree with everything that both of you have said. I just wanted to kind of slightly play devil's advocate, because we're very much focusing on kind of negatives at Kawasaki and positives at Marinos. But, you know, a lot of the top talent from J-League's already been taken out. What about the likes of Ado Onairu or Daizen Maeda? They've played so well this year that, especially Onairu, I could see a few European teams coming in for him. And there's no guarantee those players will be kind of there at the end of the season. And also, with the sheer volume of games has been in so many different competitions. When I was like kind of researching the Marinos game, I actually forgot in all of the shuffle that Marinos have still got a caretaker manager. I believe Kevin Muscat's the man they've kind of identified to come in. But it almost seems like, because things have been going so well, like Ange's just left it on autopilot and said, don't touch anything, everything will be fine. And they've just kind of run with that. But when a new coach comes in, they'll feel the need to maybe kind of change a couple of things. I mean, Sam, do you think there's any chance that bringing in someone, Kevin Muscat or otherwise, could upset the apple cart a little bit at Marinos and deprive us of the kind of title challenge we're looking for?
I think it definitely could upset the apple cart. You saw it at Tokushima, where things were sort of left in autopilot after Ricardo Rodriguez left. Then he comes in, he has his own ideas, and it all goes a little bit to pot. So maybe, unless Kevin Muscat wants to do it by Zoom, that seemed to work for Poyatos. But yeah, if I was Yokohama, if Marinos, I would keep it as it is until the end of the season and then get your new manager in over the winter. Then you can put your own his own ideas in. I don't think it makes too much sense to try and get a manager in now where, who knows when Kevin Muscat, if it is going to be him, when is he going to get into the country? Then how is he really going to adapt his style and get that sorted towards the end of the season? We might have like 15 games maybe at most. So yeah, absolutely, just leave it alone if I was them. But as for the players, I mean, Maeda I could see leaving, but maybe he's slightly saved by the Olympics now. Mm. I could see him. I think it might be a season too early for Anaiwa to go. This is kind of the first year that he's actually been prolific. He's always had the talent, but there's always been a couple of question marks about him, his finishing. So I don't think he'll be on the European radar just at the moment. I think it might be a further year down the line. But yeah, it is always a problem if you lose players like Maeda. And I mean, it's just a nightmare for me at the moment, the amount of talent that's leaving the league. We got lucky last year, but all my players are leaving, and it's quite sad and depressing.
Well, yes, and I think, Johnny, wasn't Esaka to Kawasaki originally your idea? So, yeah, it's a real shame that Frontale weren't listening at the time, because, yeah, they would have had themselves an excellent player, and I would say, yeah, a perfect fit for their system. But as Sam says, yes, Reds have stolen a march on them by taking Ataru Esaka off Kashiwa Reysol. And in related news, a player has gone in the opposite direction early this week, with Yuki Muto leaving Urawa and joining Kashiwa Reysol. So hardly an earth-shattering transfer, guys, but I guess, yes, so Kasper Juncker, although Muto did seem to combine very well with Juncker in some of his early appearances, but for now, Muto requested the move as he wasn't getting enough regular games, and obviously Reysol have gaps to fill up front, so Muto might be afforded more of an opportunity to play more regularly there. Before we wrap up part one, Sam mentioned a lot of his favourites are leaving, with obviously Mitoma almost certainly to be the latest example. But hold on to your hats, guys, because it does also appear that Kyogo Furuhashi, everybody's favourite J-League players, is also set to depart the league this summer, with strong rumours linking him to either PSV or Anderlecht. But I also saw a few Celtic supporters on Twitter wondering whether he might be a very good first signing from the J-League for Ange Postecoglou to take over to Parkhead, guys. I'm not sure whether Ange will be raiding his former club, Yokohama F. Marinos, or not, but he would certainly know all about Kyogo Furuhashi. And I think if Celtic supporters were to check out some Furuhashi highlights on YouTube, their mouths would be watering at the prospect of Furuhashi playing in Postecoglou's system. So I don't know, Johnny, do you think Furuhashi would fit in well at Celtic, and indeed in the Scottish Premier League?
I think, like, again, with Mitoma Furuhashi, I could only wish him the best. Like, coming through from Gifu to Kobe and doing what he's doing, like 14 goals this season, he's definitely earned his move to Europe. I would probably say I think PSV sounds like a better move to me, more because of the kind of physical nature of the Scottish game. Like Sam said, like, going directly from Japan to England is quite a difficult move, and obviously the Premiership in England's a far higher standard than the one in Scotland. But we saw with like Ryotaro Meshino when he went from Gamba to Man City and then to Scotland. Although Furuhashi does have the skills and talents to make the Celtic like fans' mouth water with what he's done at Kobe, I'm not convinced that would be the first stop in Europe. But I think PSV would be my pick for him. What about you, Sam?
I think he would fit in very well at PSV. It's like wonderfully attacking team in a really open league, and I mean, I think he could fill his boots playing either up front or down the left hand side. It'd be good to see him and Doan maybe link up at PSV. So that'd be really interesting. As for Celtic, well, first of all, you'd have to look into your crystal ball and see if he's got enough points to get a work permit first and foremost. I have no idea. He's played enough international, so maybe, but yeah, who knows. But at least with Celtic, you're playing with, like, when Meschino went, it was chucked in at Hearts, and like every game's a battle for Hearts. But where at Celtic, at least you're going to be in a team that is always on the attack, is always there, so going forward. So it might be a slightly better fit going up to that level of club. But yeah, I would always caution against going into Scotland or England first. I think you can get your grounding at PSV. Anderlecht as well as the other option. I think it's a weaker team than PSV. I think he would learn more, I think, at PSV, surrounded by slightly better players. But, I mean, Anderlecht, and I think it's a decent enough grounding if he does end up there. It's a similar level of team to PSV in terms of their standing in the Belgian league. And I think, yeah, he would take to the Belgian league very, very well. But, yeah, PSV looks to me like the best option for him. But who knows at the moment? It's kind of more reports at the moment. It's like almost seems certain that he will leave, but it's still open-ended to where he goes. But if he's in Holland, if he's in Belgium, I'm sure he'll do very well and hit the ground running. But at Celtic, it's a little bit more of a coin flip.
Yeah, fair enough then. So obviously the strong rumours are linking him with a move to Holland. But I think it was wishful thinking perhaps from some Celtic supporters who were hoping that, they might also be in for the prolific Kobe forward. All right, well, we ever so briefly mentioned Richard Doan there. We're talking about PSV. He scored twice for Japan's under-24s tonight as they beat Honduras 3-1 in a pre-Olympic tune-up game. And Maya Yoshida scored the other goal. And, if you're wondering, listeners, we'll be looking more in-depth at the men's and women's Olympic football tournaments in next week's episode. All right, so we're to wrap up part one then, and one final point that I wanted to say. Several incidents of utterly abhorrent racism on social media came to light over the weekend. We don't want to give those idiots any publicity at all, but we'll just reiterate that the JTalk podcast is opposed to racism in all forms and formats, and if you come across any racist posts on social media, please report to get the offenders banned. Thank you. Okay, so a lot to get through in part one, and now let's get to the meat and potatoes of this episode, J1 Match Day 22. The seven-game slate looked fairly underwhelming on paper, but we should have known not to get complacent. This is Amazing J. This is Chaos Energy J League after all, Sam. And it was a pretty special weekend for the underdog, with three bottom five teams beating top half ACL spot chasing opponents. Beginning on Saturday with the second from bottom Oita taking down fifth placed Urawa 1-0 at home.
Yeah, it was an incredible game, really, considering how poorly Oita have been playing in recent games and how much positivity we seem to have from Urawa and the way that they've been developing. But this game went completely against the script. I mean, from the first minute, Oita were on the front foot. They actually threw bodies forward. They were getting players in the box for crosses, and they really took the game to Reds, and Reds didn't cope with it, especially that first 45 minutes. I thought it was a terrific performance from Oita. Reds, got back into the game a little bit in the second half, but didn't create too many chances. And, I mean, Oita, I thought, were fairly comfortable. And it's, a very well-earned victory. And it gives them more hope in that relegation battle.
Most definitely. So Trinita came in, as I said, second from bottom. They're winless in their past four, and they hadn't scored in any of those games. But, Johnny, they were straight out of the blocks, and their pressing was obviously very apparent early and very effective early. And they took a 12-minute lead when a completely unmarked Yamato Machida steered home a lovely cushioned header from Seigo Kobayashi's cross. It should have been 2-0 just two minutes later, but Shun Nagasawa dragged his shot well wide after, once again, effective Oita pressing rocked Reds. So flipping it on its head, Johnny, and talking about Reds, I mean, I think we mentioned it last week after the draw at Sendai that, Reds indeed are not a finished product yet, and we have to keep remembering that. And, they'd worked their way up to fifth in the table you know, on merit, and no questions about that. But yeah, they were still capable of putting in the odd ordinary performance here or there. And I said, I think I said myself that, yeah, Red supporters might have to take a poor result like last weekend a few more times before the end of the season. And little did I expect that, yeah, the following weekend they'd be losing away at the team who came in second from bottom.
Yeah, this has actually been something that's been kind of on my mind for a while. It's not necessarily Reds fans themselves, but there's a lot of people talking about, like, Reds for the Champions League this year or potential, like, title contenders next year. It's easy to forget this is the same team that got absolutely hammered by Kawasaki and Marinos in March. They've just added Kasper Juncker, and Rodriguez's ideas have got over a bit more, but there's still a few kind of weak links out there, and I think one thing, if I was a Reds fan, I'd be slightly concerned about is they've very quickly become very reliant on Kasper Juncker, and he didn't have his best game. He wasn't given much support in this match. And I think I wrote down in my notes, no Juncker, no party. And Sam, like you, I think you mentioned on Twitter at halftime, they'd thrown on Sugimoto with a kind of slightly sarcastic comment about how good he was going to be. And you were proven exactly correct. I think he'd one shot from outside the box, but he didn't do much. But yeah, I think... Yeah, the Reds bandwagon. Reds, I mean, obviously they were bottom half last year and 2 years ago. We wouldn't expect them to finish there again. They're a massive club, and not just in Japan, but in Asia. But yeah, all the kind of, you mentioned, like Esaka, Schultz, Hiroki Sakai, none of these guys are registered to play yet. And maybe just as, again, a bit of devil's advocate, but if you look at names like Leandro Pereira, Adam Taggart, Daiki Kaneko at Reds, Ryuya Morishita, Junior Santos, like 6 months ago in pre-season, they all looked like great signings. Halfway through this season, not quite so good. So, yeah, Reds are going to be... A lot of what Dan said last week was really interesting, because I didn't know much about it, about the kind of front office stuff. They're obviously a team that's going places. How quickly they get there, or what the eventual kind of maximum spot they get to is up for debate. Another kind of concern would be, there's a stat came up like after like 32 minutes of this game, said Oita had 8 shots to Urawa 0. That's not really good enough from a Reds perspective, is it, really?
No, not at all. So, yeah, what Johnny's mentioned Juncker there, Sam. So, I mean... I guess it passes for a drought what he's gone through in the past few games after the quickfire start he made to his Reds career. Is it just simply a lack of support and a lack of service in the past few games that's seen him go without a goal, or is his performances suffering a little bit that you've noticed in the past few weeks?
Well, I think, especially in the last couple of games, he's come up against a bit more sturdy defences, teams that are, that's kind of, that's for their first and foremost, with Sendai and with Oita, and especially Sendai. They've kind of been able to nullify teams that did it to Yokohama. So, yeah, gave him no real space and cut the supply, which is, at the moment, it's pretty much Koizumi or bust. So if you keep Koizumi quiet, you kind of keep Reds quiet, and there's not, unless Juncker does something magical like a run from the halfway line, which he is capable of, there's not really a lot going for them. And that was the biggest issue I had, rather than just Sugimoto coming on. But by bringing Sugimoto on, they dropped Koizumi again into that central midfield role, which I absolutely hate when you put him deep, because it just completely cuts him out of the game. There's no link up there. And yeah, they just didn't work. Like, Sugimoto had no real connection with Juncker. It wasn't like it was a front two that could combine to create anything. That was really their problem. And the other issues are where you've still got this a makeshift team with Akimoto, who's not a left back, at left back, and then he was kind of caught out for the goal. He was then caught out a bit late, I think, for the Nagasawa chance as well. So there are still issues with this team, but I think I may have been guilty of buying into the hype a little bit when you see the players that came in. And if I predict Reds to do well, as Ryan Steele knows, they usually then go on to do pretty poorly. So I'm sorry about that. But yeah, there is definitely still work to do. And it would be interesting. I really want to know how they're going to fit Koizumi and Esaka into this team, because Koizumi does need the help in terms of the creativity. But if they just get in each other's way, it could be an absolute nightmare for them. And it might just kind of nullify both players. So he's got a lot to do, Rodriguez, over this kind of Olympic break. So they're a fascinating team to look at. But yeah, they weren't necessarily fascinating on Saturday.
No, not at all. Yeah, the very flat first half from Reds, as we said, they got caught cold in the first 15 minutes and saw Oita take the lead. They did better in the first 15 minutes of the second half for Urawa, but in a weekend of contentious refereeing decisions, Sam, what did you make of the non-awarding of a penalty to Oita just past the hour when Kobayashi's cross hit the arm of Takahiro Akimoto? There were a couple of similar incidents over the weekend. This one wasn't given a penalty, and we've talked long and many times about the silhouette etc. When it comes to handballs this year, was that ultimately a correct decision reached, do you think?
Just about. I think I always hate these handball ones because they're always a little bit harsh at this point. It is, his arm is slightly out, but yeah, I would just err on the side of not giving it, especially when on the field it's not given. I don't think there was enough scope for VAR to overturn it. So, yeah, maybe Oita could feel a little bit hard done to, but I would just about err on the side of agreeing with the referee.
All right, then. So both of these sides will enjoy pretty much a full Olympic break. With the exception of Oita, they have just one game to play during the Olympic break, and that is away to Johnny's Gumbra Osaka side on the 27th of July. Ricardo Rodriguez will have the full break to hopefully bed in his new signings and tweak his system before the league as a whole resumes on the 9th of August. So, yes, it was a great victory for Oita, and indeed, sorry, Johnny, but it did take them above Gumba in the table and up a spot to 18th. But of course, Gumba have six games in hand on Trinita. So I'm sure by the time the league as a whole resumes, and indeed by the time Trinita visit Gumba on the 27th, they will be back behind the black and blue half of Osaka. But yes, that was a great weekend for Trinita. And if that was a surprise, well then, yeah, what about on Sunday, Johnny, when bottom club, the cellar dwellers, Yokohama FC, who had not won in seven games, and indeed had only won once all season, travelled down to the Edion Stadium to meet Hiroshima, who came in unbeaten in five and in ninth spot in the table. Wouldn't you know it? Yes, Amazing J, Chaos Energy J League, the cellar dwellers went and stunned their hosts also by a 1-0 scoreline.
Yeah, this kind of game backed up a couple of things that we've talked about when I've been on here before. Like in the preseason preview, we picked out Hiroshima not having much depth. And then the last time it was on the team of the half season, we're talking about Hayao Kawabe. And I think Sam said something like, Hayao Kawabe is Hiroshima. And this is the first game they played without him. And then they had Asano was injured, Shibasaki was injured, Osaka was with the Olympic team. And then Morishima looked like he picked up a nasty shoulder injury in the first half. Yeah, I can't say Yokohama FC didn't deserve it. They gave Hiroshima an early warning. Sasaki was booked for hauling down Ogawa, and then Maejima carved them open from a defensive corner, and Ogawa rounded the goalie to score. I mean, Hiroshima came back, that they had chances. I never really felt like they were going to score, and probably the one where Morishima injured his shoulder was their best chance. I thought Junior Santos was disappointing. He was too selfish again. They took off Fuji, the right wing back. They're back to playing like a back three again. They took off Fuji at half time. I thought he was doing okay. Brought on Naganuma, took him off 30 minutes later. Didn't look happy. Didn't look like he was injured. Brought on Douglas Vieira, which by that point it was too late. Yeah, I know. Obviously they've got Hiroshima get 30 points already. They can crawl into mid table like the rest of the season. But I mean, where they really go? They don't have a lot of money. They've basically said like, we can only bring in university players. I think they've got a couple coming in from Yutsukezai next year, and they've got Kawamura, who's been doing a good job, and Lona Ehime to come back in. And it's just kind of J2 players after that. They've brought in, I think, Jelani Rishon Sumiyoshi, who's done a good job at Mito, but centre-backs, Hiroshima's strong point. It's not really the signing they need. So it's interesting because I think Yokohama FC, they have a player there, Tatsuki Seko, in central midfield, who would be a pretty good replacement for Kawabe. He may have interest from other clubs. And yeah, Yokohama FC, defence has always looked the weak point this year, but they weren't really tested that much in this game. Defence looked quite solid. The wing backs were pretty good, especially Maejima. So, yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, Sam, you're obviously a big fan of Kawabe. Where do Hiroshima go from here? How do they replace him?
Oh, very good question. They've got to do something. I was looking over their team this weekend, and, I mean, you're just picking the bones out. There's not a lot there when they're... I didn't get to see this game. I've only seen the highlights of it, but Heiner in midfield, he's a right winger that they've played at wing back, and now they've tried to shove him into central midfield. I don't know how well he played, and maybe you could shed some light on that. But yeah, really, they've got a massive gap to fill, because I think he was doing the job of at least one and a half players, maybe two in that midfield, because I think Aoyama is going to get caught out a lot without him next to him. And yeah, they've just got to find someone from somewhere. I mean, just trying to think off the top of my head where I would look to get someone. I wonder if you could get Daiki Kaneko off Reds just as a loan spell, just to fill in there. And you know, I don't really know where else to look at the moment, to be honest. But I mean, it was just, they must have seen it coming, Kawabe leaving, because he is obviously their best player. So hopefully, just for their sake, they've got some sort of contingency plan in place, and they've got this break now where they can bed someone in and sort themselves out. But I was looking before this weekend and just thinking, is it viable to have a hot take that Hiroshima are in a relegation battle now? And I think you're right that they can just about crawl themselves into safety, but yeah, I just really fear for them at the moment. And it's been highlighted that they've not really got a great deal of finances behind them. They did get Junior Santos in, but that was all they could muster in the winter transfer window. And as is kind of typical with all J-League players going into Europe, you don't get a great deal of money for them, even though you should do a lot more. So I think they've got a real battle on their hands. I don't think they'll go down this year. But next year, if they do not sort that out, especially when you've got to think, Ayama's 35 now, how much longer can he really go? And yeah, they've got a massive gap to fill in there. So I fear for them. But yeah, what was the makeshift kind of midfield like?
I think you didn't actually watch the game, but you've obviously got a very good feel for football, because yeah, Ayama looked his age, and Heiner, I think, took free kicks, and I didn't really notice him much apart from that. I think, yeah, the problem is, like I mentioned Seko earlier, Seko and Takahashi for Yokohama FC, they look quite comfortable. They had a lot of time in the ball. And, yeah, Yokohama FC, they were solid against Hiroshima. But when Gamba played Yokohama FC, they got in behind them double the amount of times they've got in behind the rest of every other team in J-League combined, whereas... Yeah, I think they brought on Akuyama, the young kind of attacking midfielder forward. Ayukawa, sorry. And he kind of put himself around, but he's the kind of player, he looks very good technically, but he doesn't score any goals. But he was just kind of bulldozing his way through the middle. There wasn't much like craft or guile. So, yeah, I mean, Hiroshima with 30 points, they've got 16 games left to play. I know in England they say it's the mythical like 40 points to be saved, so... 10 points from 16 games. There's no way they're not going to get that, but it's not, yeah, it's not looking good. It was interesting, actually, the last time after I was on and we're doing our J team of the half season, one of the kind of topics I saw discussed was like Hiroshima fans saying it was disgraceful that Inagaki and Salomonson both made our team but had been let go by Hiroshima, and they were kind of questioning front office decisions. So, yeah, they've obviously got a new stadium coming, but I don't know how much that's eating up their finances. On the field at the moment, though, things don't look particularly rosy, I'd have to say.
Yeah, I tell you what, Johnny, I think Aoyama spent all of his petrol tickets for the day on that one sprint trying to chase down Keijiro Ogawa on the 11th minute goal. I don't think he was the same after that. I mean, he did toil manfully, and he almost got to Ogawa, who almost cocked up his chance after taking the ball around Takato Hayashi, who dashed out of his area 40 yards from goal for no apparent reason. But yeah, that was the only goal of the game then. Ogawa, as you say, Johnny, sent clear by Yota Maejima, a ball right down Main Street, and Ogawa ultimately finished off the job. And yeah, great for the insurance salesman Yuji Rokutan to get a clean sheet, and indeed the much maligned Yutaro Hakamata. Sam, you would have been stunned to see this result, I suppose, and that Hakamata played in it, Yokohama FC getting a clean sheet. And yeah, great for Rokutan, who did make a couple of good saves in the second half, as Johnny says there. Are you Kiyokawa had a good chance that Rokutan saved with his boot. And, yeah, I guess Hiroshima huffed and puffed late on, but yes, could find no way past the insurance salesman as, yeah, Yokohama FC claimed just their second win of the season. And, yeah, there was an appearance from Yusuke Matsuo for the last half hour or so here, Johnny. So, yeah, just quickly before we leave this game, we know how impressive was Matsuo was last season up until the point, obviously, where his season was ended by injury. He would have had a bit of rust to shake off, I presume, but how did he look in the half hour or so that he was on the pitch?
It's interesting you brought him up because I'd written down in my notes, like, he would definitely be worth a team taking a punt on him now when his value is low. Not Gamba, as I'd suggested before, because we've got a horrible record of players coming back from injury and then getting re-injured again. Honestly, the point when he came on, Yokohama FC were just sitting back and defending, so he didn't really have any chance to show any kind of fluency in attack. He did. If you were scouting him and just on this game, you wouldn't have thought anything. But yeah, if someone is looking for a bit of a bargain, wanting to take a bit of a punt on someone, we remember how well he did last year, and he's been in and out of the team with injury this year. If I was a kind of director of football or something, he's someone I would definitely be considering. Even like Kawasaki, they have a kind of history of bringing in that type of player. Wouldn't be massively shocked if he was someone they might look at to replace Mitoma.
Tasty. Yeah, I like it. Okay. All right then. So yeah, the third bottom half club to upset a top half opponent on the weekend was Kashiwa. And Sam, you picked this as your pick of the weekend in last week's episode. And yeah, I think you made a pretty good choice here. This game at the Hitachi Dai saw Reysol, who had won just one of their last 10 in the league. And that was, of course, in somewhat contentious circumstances away at Shonan, who had two goals that we believe were perfectly legitimate, ruled out by VAR, but that was indeed ultimately a Reysol win. They hosted Kashima, who Sam says set for a second half of the season surge, but I guess we'll have to wait until after the Olympic break for that, Sam, because, yes, after a scoreless first half, Reysol took the game by the scruff of the neck with two goals in 4 second half minutes. Shortly after, he dragged a rangefinder well wide. Cristiano blasted Kashiwa in front after he was sent racing clear by Sachiro Toshima. Yuya Oki getting a hand to the shot, but the force on the ball took it into the top corner. It certainly wasn't the most elegant knee slide in celebration you've ever seen from the Brazilian, but a trademark pile driver it was. And then his compatriot Pedro Raul fired in a terrific second. Cristiano was involved in the build-up, and Takuma Ominami crossed from the right. Pedro Raul's first-time blast flashed past Oki and high into the net. Antlers set up a nervy finale for their hosts after Tomoya Inukai headed in a cross from Katsuya Nagato in the 89th minute, but the masses at Hitachi Dai went wild at the final whistle, a huge win that nudged them up to 15th. So, Johnny, yeah, Sam got one right here. That was quite an entertaining second half. And, yeah, for Reysol, to say it's a much-needed victory is obviously a massive understatement.
Yeah, this is a massive, massive win. You asked me to come on the pod kind of before this game was played, and I was thinking of things to say. And I think if Kashiwa had lost this, there's a chance they might have taken the Olympic break to make a change of manager. They may indeed go ahead and do that. But I think winning against a strong opponent like Kashima, and especially like Pedro Raul's goal, that's 3 in 5 for him. They really need him to come good to replace the Olunga like goals from last year. A couple of interesting points as well, because obviously you mentioned like Sachiro Toshima had that horrible leg break against Marinos last year. It's great to see him back in contributing. It's very distinctive with his shirt tucked into his shorts.
Yeah.
The rest of the team had them all stuck out. And then Ominami, I don't know what he was doing, because he's not a player I particularly rate as a defender, but he looked like a bona fide winger, the way he cut back to Raul for the seconds. But what I was going to ask Sam about, like, but both of these managers, because with Kashiwa, like, they've played 22 games this season, and I think there's a lot of question marks still around, like, what is their best formation? Who are their best players? which five of the eight foreigners they have on their books deserve to be in the starting lineup and which three should be in the stands. I know that the kind of two times I've been on J-Talk Extra Time this year, I've talked with John about like Matsumoto Yamaga. There's a lot of stuff you could just copy and paste, I think, from those conversations applied to Kashiwa. Like, what are they trying to achieve? They've got a very good youth system. Like you saw, like you mentioned, Sasaki came in a few weeks ago. Hosoya scored last week. Signed a lot of players from other J1 and J2 teams. They've got eight foreigners in the books for whatever reason. It's not a new rule that's caught them out. So I was wondering, Sam, their kind of trials this season. Do you think, is it down to Nelsinho? Is it poor front office management? Is it the players themselves? Well, where do you think the blame kind of lies?
I think, well, a combination of all three, but the buck stops with the manager, and he's the one who's bringing these players in. He's the one who, you've got to look at it and think, okay, he must have a way of playing that he wants his team to play. You'd expect, well, a manager should do that. And then you sign the players to get that. I mean, he's picked these foreign players out. I mean, Emerson played, like, I think he's played 2.5 games, looked absolute dross. I think he's about to leave them pretty soon, so that was a complete waste of time. I don't like Angelotti at all, and like, he's played 4 at the back, he's played 3 at the back. I think he was in two minds for most games. He's just chopping and changing. He has no real idea, I don't think, what his best team is. He's bringing in Yuki Muto, which is just going to give him another headache. I just think there are kind of too many options at the moment, and he's just he reacts to one defeat and thinks, oh, I'll throw everything out and go again. Because there was that one period where they, I think I mentioned it a few times, where they were forced into a way of playing due to the various injuries that they have, and then had to play on this kind of 4-3-3, and Nakano was there, Osaka at the time, and Kamiya, and it really worked well. But for two or three games, and then I think they maybe got a defeat, and then he just chucked it out, and then just decided to go with all the foreign players, and then that didn't work, so he chucked that out again. So he's just not settling on anything. I thought this would have been his final game. If he lost, I thought it would have been a perfect time to break with him and move in a different direction. But, I mean, he's pulled a rabbit out of the hat with this victory, and yeah, fair play to him, and I imagine he's going to continue, and now it'll probably be till the end of the season. But you can see with this team, if you can figure out how to get all these pieces into the right place, then it can really work. I thought, just from seeing the highlights of this game, the build-up play, the interchange with Cristiano and Pedro Raul, they looked like they had a decent understanding. And I think if you add Muto just in behind that, I think that it could be a very intriguing trio. So, there are definite positives to take out of that. And just I've just got to hope for Kashima's sake that Nelsinho just kind of calms down a little bit, kind of takes stock in these next few weeks, figure things out, figure out exactly how he wants to play, exactly what players he does, and then just stick with it and don't just overreact to one defeat or to one victory or anything like that. And yeah, there's definitely the players, as I've said pretty much all season, that they shouldn't be getting relegated. So yeah, very positive for Kashima. As for Kashima, they were a bit of a mess, I thought, in this one. But yeah, as Ben said, I predicted them to go really well. So obviously that was going to come back and bite me.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Sam, about, because we mentioned obviously Nelsinho, who's a legend at Kashiwa. And Kashima also have a legend like Naoki Soma's in charge. And I remember after Gamba lost to Kawasaki Frontale earlier in the year, and that was Miyamoto's final game, like Neil Debnam wrote about how he didn't really want Kengo Nakamura taking over at Kawasaki because of the problems you can have when club legends don't do well. I think I asked you before as well about like Zago. We kind of agreed that he might feel a bit harshly treated to be let go, possibly Go Oiwa as well. It seems like Kashima have just kind of kept on the same trajectory regardless of who's in the hot seat. And I almost have the feeling like Naoki Soma wouldn't be getting appointed at any other club of the stature of Kashima. Like Marinos wouldn't go for him or Urawa wouldn't go for him. It was a very underwhelming appointment for me. And he's made an interesting call in midfield. He's dropped, I think, one of your favourites, Kento Misao. And he's gone for the Pituka and Leo Silva combination in midfield. He's obviously got Arthur Kaikes come in and they're trying to get the most out of him. Everaldo's got, I think, 7 goals in the cup, and he's only scored once in J1. You have to think he's going to score more goals in the second half of this year. But I wonder maybe if Zago, being Brazilian, might have had a better kind of relationship with the other Brazilian, with the Brazilian players. So I just wanted to get, what did you think, Sam? Soma's appointment, how well can we expect him to do there?
Well, yeah, Soma's appointment was kind of like the typical J-League appointment where they sack a manager and then just dip into the backroom staff and pick someone out from there, whoever seems the greatest. And I mean, it worked, I suppose, when Ishii left and then they brought in Oiwa, they just promoted him. That worked really well. I mean, as for in terms of like club legends and whatnot, I mean, you're kind of speaking to the wrong person as a Man United supporter, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the same sort of manager, because he wouldn't get into Chelsea or Arsenal or anything like that. But there is something a little bit about it in terms of you kind of have that feel of the fabric of the place. Kashima forever just play the same way. You know what Kashima are about. They've got that kind of DNA, and you expect him to go on. I mean, it's not like he's just been thrust into it either. I mean, he had a long spell as the Match of the Zelvia manager, so it's not like you've just plucked someone completely out of nowhere. But, I mean, I would have stuck with Zago, as you mentioned. I thought he's obviously brought these players in. He did it last year and got out of a little bit of a hole. And you just thought, yeah, it would have worked well with him, because still, I don't think you've got the best out of Everaldo this season. Pituca, I really like Pituca. I think he's a very good player, but I think you have lost a little bit of the balance by putting him and Leo Silva in that midfield together without Kento Misao. So, yeah, I think maybe Zago could have done a little bit more with it. But, yeah, I'm not hugely against the appointment of Soma. I think they were just I think the idea was just to get back to Kashima being Kashima, which they thought they'd lost a little bit with the way Zaga was doing. I know there was a lot of talk from what I was reading just in terms of the training methods. It wasn't really clicking with the players. They weren't buying into what Zaga was doing. So they thought, let's get back to basics. And I still believe that it will get better for them and they will be real contenders for the Champions League this season. But maybe it's still a little bit of a work in progress for Soma.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, great stuff, Sam. And yeah, good questioning there, Johnny. Good to get Sam's thoughts on the managerial situations at both Reysol and Antlers. Reysol, yes, they have the full Olympic break to decide what they're going to do with Nel Senior, whether they'll stand pat or whether they'll make a change over the break. While the Antlers have just one game in the break, and they're another team that have to visit the Panasonic Stadium to face Gumba. In fact, they'll be there the weekend of the 24th. That's 3 days before the Oita game that we mentioned previously. All right, so yeah, three shocks with the bottom half teams stunning top half opponents. But elsewhere in the match day, it was pretty much business as usual, especially at Mitsuzawa, where second place, the Yokohama F. Marinos, took care of Fukuoka in what was, at kickoff at least, the only all top half clash on the match day 22 slate. Avispa came into this match day in 10th spot, but this 2-0 defeat at the hands of F. Marinos has seen them drop a spot, and now they head the bottom half of the table, if you like. They're now 11th in the league. F. Marinos went close in the 15th minute. Masaaki Murakami's save from a fierce Teruhito Nakagawa shot ricocheting just past the post, but the host didn't have to wait much longer before taking the lead with the summer signing own goal, continuing his good recent form for the hosts with his second goal in three games. On this occasion, Jun Amano crossed into the centre. Murakami punched, but straight off Tatsuki Nara's arm and into the net. 6 minutes later, it was 2-0, and F. Marinos were well on their way to a sixth straight league win. Elber crossing from the right, and a completely unmarked Ado Onaiwu heading back across Murakami and high into the net. In the 52nd minute, Murakami made a superb double save to twice deny Onaiwu, first from his bullet header, then his follow-up volley. Then later on, Murakami saved Kota Watanabe's header, and that was it. A very much a professional performance from F. Marinos, Sam. 2-0, and as we said earlier, they continue to apply pressure on the leaders. As we said, down the lead now for Frontale is down to 9 points, and if Marinos still have a game in hand.
Yeah, I thought they were terrific in this game, and considering Daizen Maeda wasn't there, and Marcos Junior was suspended, and Hatanaka was out injured, so they were in complete control of this game. I was quite disappointed, I'd say, with Avispa's defending, considering how good it has been this season, and how it's really been the backbone of them, and it's kept them in, they were challenging for ACL places, they're not anymore, but yeah, I thought they were slow to get out to stop crosses or not getting out at all. Elbert had all the time in the world, especially for the Onaiwu one, and there was another one later in the game, the Watanabe one. Again, so much time for the crosser. No one actually picking up their man in the box. I thought Nara kind of got a little bit rocked by the own goal because, yeah, his marking was all over the place. There was one, I think it was an Onaiwu header from close range, which Murakami saved, and Nara is just with him, and then for whatever reason just runs away from him. It was very weird defending. So, yeah, a lot of issues, I think, for Avispa, but Marinos never looked in danger in that second half. It was such a professional performance. They've kind of kept Ange as, like, plan A, and they go about it. They're still very good attacking-wise, but there is no room. The back door is completely closed at the moment. It's been, yeah, terrific at the back for them. They're on a fantastic run. They need to keep that going if they're going to call back the 9 points. But at the moment, you're not going to bet against them. Yeah, they're looking in imperious form.
Certainly, it ain't broke, so Hideki Matsunaga is not doing anything at all. As you say, he's put Ange's left it on autopilot, and Matsunaga's just letting the players go about their business, and they've racked up these results now. As we said, 6 straight league wins, Johnny, and with Frontale... Already weakened by the loss of Al Tanaka, and with Mitoma almost certain to follow him out the door at Todoroki. Yes, it does look like we're going to get a title race as F. Marinos just keep plugging away and racking up the wins.
Yeah, I think a quick plug to the very striking Marinos summer kit they were wearing. I'm not sure whether or not it was based in Fukuoka, because it looked very much like a Fukuoka home kit, but I was quite impressed with that. But yeah, like you and Sam have both said, that Marinos racking up the wins. I think 6 wins in a row, 4 clean sheets, which is not something you'd necessarily associate with, like, Ange Ball, but they're definitely getting it done at both ends. One player I wanted to mention and kind of get Sam's thoughts on, especially when we're talking about Marinos being title contenders, is Terehito Nakagawa. Because, I mean, he's someone with a career trajectory that's got a very clear and sharp peak of the second half of 2018 and 2019. I believe this is only his second start since round 8 this year. He's been plagued with injuries last year and the beginning of this. But I know a lot of the feedback from Marinos fans on Twitter was very positive about how he played. He obviously didn't score or assist, but he was involved. He was sprinting. He kind of filled in for Maeda. I mean, Sam, what kind of role do you think he's going to play in the second half of the year? And do you think he can hit those heights of 2019 again?
Well, it's interesting because prior to that, he'd done very little. And then after that, he's done very little. So it's been, yeah, you just wonder, is that just a one-off? But this game, he was involved in a lot, but I just thought he was not quite sharp enough, not quite, I think it's just not quite going for him. Maybe it is just a case that he gets one goal and then he's full of confidence and gets back in. But his chances, I think, are going to be limited just because Maeda and Elbert have been absolutely fantastic. And, I mean, they've brought in Ryo Miyachi as well, the ever-injured winger who might... I don't know if he's fit briefly. I mean, he might can be a contender for a start as well. So I think his chances are going to be limited, so he's going to have to feed off a little bit of scraps, which is not necessarily what you want to do if you're still trying to play your way back into form and back into confidence. But I really like the energy that he had in this game. He was still keen to get on the ball, still keen to try things, and it just wasn't quite working out for him. If I say that first shot, if Murakami powers in, he only just drops wide. If that just goes a little bit lucky for him, then yeah, maybe he's away. But I mean, he's a very good player to have on your bench if you can get him back towards those levels. But yeah, I just think I've not really been impressed with him for a long while now. He's just been overtaken by the players that Maeda especially has just taken that chance. And yeah, Nakagawa is just going to have to bide his time. But I mean, yeah, they've got so many good options up front. I don't think they'll be too worried, Yokohama supporters.
No, fair enough then. So, yeah, another professional performance from F. Marinos. As we said, a sixth straight win. It's a fourth straight loss for Fukuoka. And, yes, from the giddy heights of fifth, as we said, they have now slipped down to 11th in the table. But far out exceeded most people's expectations at the start of the season. And, yeah, with still a half season to go, hopefully Fukuoka can rebound and, yeah, start to nudge their way back up the table. All right, so aside from F. Marinos, FC Tokyo were the only other top half side to win over the weekend after their trip down the Tokaido line to face Shonan. I said on last week's episode, this is usually the one fixture of the year I'm allowed out for, but I certainly didn't have any regrets about not going after watching what was almost certainly the worst first half of any game in J1 this season. It was a notable only for a Shonan striker Yuki Ohashi's shot that was saved by a Go Hatano in the 22nd minute. Things did start to liven up in the second half, though, and Hatano made a superb save to tip Shuto Machino's 57th minute shot onto the woodwork. I also wasn't regretting not going after the heavens opened around the hour mark of this game, and around about the same time, Tokyo thought they had taken the lead as their Otridente did the damage again. Adailton played the ball in from the left touchline. Leandro stepped over it and took a pass from Diego Oliveira before driving forward and slotting home, only for VAR to finally intervene and disallow the goal after finding Diego a hair offside when Adailton passed the ball. But that was not the last of VAR's interventions in this game. But first, though, Tokyo finally did break the deadlock in the 83rd minute when the substitute Kensuke Nagai blasted home a volley after a Satoshi Tanaka had acrobatically blocked a Leandro shot. But then in the 90th minute, Tanaka went in two-footed on Shuto Abe. The referee produced a yellow card, much to the chagrin of several on-watching Tokyo players. Then after a lengthy break as Abe received treatment, the referee was finally summoned over to the VAR monitor, and a full 4 minutes after the tackle, changed his yellow to a straight red and sent Tanaka off. So 6 minutes of stoppage time then became 11, but Tokyo saw the game out to record a fourth straight league win that saw them edge up to seventh in the table. So I think, Sam, we're saving the jingle for the next game, which we could be talking about for another hour. But a couple of notable VAR incidents in this one. And I should stress that the correct decisions were reached ultimately in both occasions. But yeah, once again, as we seem to say on a weekly or bi-weekly basis, once again, the time it takes to come to these decisions is just unacceptable. I mean, the referee was watching Abe receiving treatment for a minute and a half before he finally made the VAR gesture and went over to look at the monitor. And once again, it's just not good enough.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot understand why everything takes as long as it does. I mean, yeah, you want to see a couple of replays, I suppose, and get a couple of angles about it. But yeah, maybe a minute, I suppose, not 4 minutes. And it just seems like they're overanalyzing everything. They're just dilly-dallying and making sure they're not making mistake and just taking absolutely forever over it. I mean, I assume it's all going to get reviewed at the end of the season about how they're doing it, and this really has to change next year, because as you say, it is every week that we are talking about fairly straightforward decisions that are taking absolutely forever to deal with. I think, I mean, the referee really should have given the red card straight away. I thought it was quite a clear poor challenge, studs up, and yeah, really nasty one. So I'm glad the decision in the end was made well, and definitely the goal that was ruled out, again, it was a good decision. It was one that wasn't maybe necessarily noticeable in just in live play, the way it was, the move built up. But yeah, definitely a correct decision. So that's good at least, and much better than the Sapporo game that we're going to come on to. But it's very frustrating. But let's get back onto a positive for it. I've built up Urawa and Kashima in recent weeks, and it's only fair now with Manager of the Month at FC Tokyo and four straight wins without conceding a goal and just 3 points off the ACL. So are you optimistic? Do you think there is a realistic push now for FC Tokyo for those ACL places, or are you still a little pessimistic?
Oh, gee whiz. Don't put the kiss of death on us just yet, Sam. I mean, it...
I have to put it to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's an impressive run of victories. They haven't all been diamond performances, but after... The month we had the five straight losses were I couldn't see a way out for Kenta Hasegawa, but he's turned it around, and as you say, a manager of the month for June, and it was only three games, but he deserves it, and he deserves credit for, I think, as we said with Dan a couple of weeks ago, just burying the hatchet with Leandro and getting him back in the team, because that has reinvigorated the entire team. Obviously, the front three garner all the headlines, and that's because they deserve it. They've been absolutely terrific over the course of this winning run. And again, there'll be far tougher tests than Shonan away to come after the Olympic break. But to have steadied the ship in the way that Tokyo have, and as you say, it surprises me every time I look at the table that yes, we're 3 points off third, albeit having played a game more. And if you'd put that to me in the middle of May, I would have thought you were absolutely bonkers. So we're in the hunt. There are a number of teams around us, and I would argue most of them have better quality. But we're in the mix. I think I'll have to admit that.
Excellent. Yeah, well, sorry for any Tokyo supporters listening. If any curse comes from this and you go on to lose the next three games.
Well, I was going to ask Ben a question as well along similar lines, because obviously as a Gamba fan, I've got fond memories of Kenta Hasegawa. And I remember there was quite kind of vociferous protest on Twitter about like almost what we were saying about like Nelsinho has like got one game to save himself. And obviously you said he's brought back Leandro. And I think if you were to kind of plot a graph of, you could stick a dot on when Leandro came back and then performances raised exponentially after that. And they seem to have buried the hatchet for now. Is there a kind of nagging doubt with Tokyo fans that this might be a kind of the calm before the storm again and the two may clash again? Or are you just kind of enjoying the moment as it is now?
Yeah, I think with Leandro, he's such a volatile character. I mean, he's you don't know what you're going to get from him on a game-to-game basis. I mean, he was booked here just before halftime for raising his arm in a challenge, and on another day a different referee might have even produced a straight red for him, considering his history. I mean, this referee, I've got a number of issues with him, Mr. Nakamura, over the course of this game. I mean, the VAR incidents notwithstanding, but I mean, the incident where he booked Leandro, I mean, there was a forceful collision, and the Shonan player stayed down, but Tokyo retained possession, and only when Tokyo stopped playing because they had a player down did the referee produce a yellow card for Leandro. Like, he wasn't going to book him in the first place. He didn't award a foul to Shonan for what had happened, but anyway, that's a by the by. But Leandro is a very volatile character, but hopefully they've buried the hatchet, and just we'll have to be wary as Tokyo supporters of Leandro and his actions on the pitch, not the relationship between him and the manager. And I would just hope that Leandro is really enjoying his football, because the way that those three Brazilian forwards combine, I mean, it is a joy to watch at times. And it's, Tokyo supporters want to see that continue. And hopefully Leandro really enjoys playing with his mates, Adailton and Diego Oliveira. And he wouldn't want to do anything to jeopardise that. Or at least that's what I keep telling myself before I go to sleep, Johnny. So, let's just cross our fingers and hope the good times continue to roll. And, wherever it takes Tokyo, we'll just have to wait and see.
So it sounds good, I think, because you said the attackers got all the credit, but at the back, that's seven clean sheets in eight games, and you've got a promising player like Junior Suzuki to come in at right back, and it seems like a good thing you've got apologies if he's listening to this, Kashif Bandunagande. Mm-hmm. I think I've got that right. So he's coming at left back and Ogawa's gone to right back. So I think that's really going to help that, because Suzuki, he's got half a season in J2 and he's been in J3 before. So if he doesn't have to come in and play right from the beginning, because from the outside, it seems like Tokyo have like some good fullbacks on a sort of one-off basis, but they might not be able to consistently put performances together. So if they have some options like Suzuki and Kashif and Ogawa, and then obviously Nakamura when he comes back, it's obviously good to have options. And Bruno Ivini, he's not really featured. So at the start of the season, I think I pointed out Tokyo didn't have much depth in defence, but now they're putting that kind of run together, and it looks like, yeah, it looks like you really could challenge for top four, top five this year. So it's looking good for you guys. I'm a bit jealous.
Well, yes, mate. Yeah, we have turned it around, and yeah, the defense was so shaky during that horrible run that it was hard to see them turning it around. But yeah, the Morishige in midfield experiment is well and truly put to bed, I think, now, and he's settled back with alongside Watanabe. And yeah, I've been surprised to not see Ivini feature in the league yet. But I think we've got a good one on our hands in Bangunagande, and it was an excellent pronunciation by you, by the way, absolutely tremendous. And I mean, Ogawa, yeah, he's just not, it still stuns me that he's ever played for the Japan national team. But he's a decent player at this level, but he's never pulling up any trees. And the only chance in the first half came when Ogawa was lazy, pulling himself up to the offside line and played Ohashi on. So just another example of Ogawa's sloppiness, in my opinion. But hopefully Bangunagande and this Suzuki fella can come in and give Ogawa perhaps a run for his money, because I'd rather see Kashif keep his spot for the most part. All right, but let's try and put a lid on any Tokyo expectations here, because I won't be able to handle it. But we'll wrap up the episode, and it has been a lengthy one already, listeners. But we appreciate you sticking with us with the two draws to finish off the match day. And, as I think I mentioned briefly earlier, this next game, it could be an hour-long episode in and of itself, Sam. But 17th place Sendai hosted Sapporo. The game ended 1-1. That doesn't tell anything of this hugely contentious game with, refereeing decisions, VAR mistakes, clear mistakes to all of us looking on. I'll tell you what, I'll play the jingle now and then we'll just run through some of the major incidents from this game. This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. So the first incident, Sam, obviously took place in the fourth minute when visiting Consadole took a fourth-minute lead. Lucas Fernandez blasted across Jakub Slovic, but he looked clearly offside to me when Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa played Takuro Kaneko's headed knockdown out to him on the right. So, the referee and VAR, are they 0-1 here on messed-up decisions?
Well, I think so. This match left me questioning many things, and definitely my eyesight, because I was convinced he was offside, and I've watched this about five or six times. Nothing has changed my mind there. Maybe they're just using the ultra-thick lines whenever they're coming up with it. But yeah, it just looked offside to me. I mean, we were proven wrong with that Shonan one maybe a couple of months ago, where the judge replay then brings out everything and it shows that, okay, he was. They might show that this is onside, but everything that I've seen with my eyes suggests this was fairly comfortably offside and not just a little bit.
Yes, now, I think one of the few decisions they got right on this day, Johnny, was in the ninth minute when Ogashiwa himself fired home what he thought was a Sapporo second goal, but this time the linesman had his flag up and the goal was disallowed. So I think we can give them a little bit of credit for this one. So it's 1-1.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got plenty of things to nail them down on, so let's at least give them credit for calling it an offside.
Right, now, who wants to take the one in the in the 24th minute when Hiroki Miyazawa volleyed in what was, again, Sapporo's second goal, the third time they had the ball in the net. They thought they were going 2-0 up when, Miyazawa volleyed in. But this time, VAR stepped in and called the referee over for a look. The goal, I believe, was chalked off, and not for Chanatip running rings around Jakub Slovic inside the 6-yard box. But for Ryota Aoki, blocking the run of Kyohei Yoshino as he attempted to mark his man well off the ball. So, well, if you take it in turns, I guess, Sam, you, you've got to go next. So, yeah, obviously a good volley from Miyazawa. Such a shame to see it chalked off for such a Tiggy Touchwood decision.
Yeah, this was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Every corner sees collisions, sees blocks off. It's just a tactic. It's just what everyone does. Like, it's not like Aoki has stepped across and blocked him off. He's just standing there. And if anything, he's backing away as he runs into him. And I can't think who it was that ran into Aoki, but he wasn't actually going to make get the ball. He wasn't running to it. It'd be behind the Sapporo player that headed it across. I just thought this was ridiculous. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it just didn't occur to me that they'd even look for this sort of thing. And then I've seen it, and just, yeah, Aoki does nothing except stand there. And if being run into means you're conceding a foul, then what hope has anyone got? I mean, just ridiculous. I just, refereeing this was just, I don't know if it was just trying to cause a scene or just trying to be involved in everything, but yeah, this was just, I just don't understand it at all. It was just a horrendous decision, and if this is a foul, then there is a foul on every corner, and we might as well not bother.
I think if a goal is scored and the referee gives it, and you're shown multiple replays that doesn't show like anything obvious, I think you'd have to read Alki's mind and think, yeah, he's deliberately blocking him off. There's nothing he does that we can see from outside his brain that shows he's deliberately doing that. I don't see how they can justify like chalking a goal like that off. A very good goal by Miyazawa, as you said.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be like the referee Yuichi Nishimura to want to be the centre of attention or anything like that. So, yeah, we'll give him a pass on this occasion. So, well, yeah, I mean, Sapporo... yeah, I mean, the Ogashiwa one in the 9th minute was correctly ruled out. So that's, yeah, Sapporo should really have been 2-0 up and, yeah, in cruise control. But so after not being at the races at all in the first half hour, Sendai then equalised, of course, in the 31st minute when Felipe Cardoso played the ball out to Shuhei Akasaki on the left. And the right back, Takumi Masai, steered in a terrific volley from his inch-perfect cross for his first J1 goal. So there you go, Johnny. Again, amazing J. Yes, Sendai had barely had a kick in the first half hour and, yeah, have one chance and take it. Although, it must be said, in a terrific fashion.
Yeah, I think Masai has been one of the players who's sort of quietly impressed in quite a difficult season for Sendai. And Felipe Cardoso, I think Sam spoke about him a few weeks ago. He's someone who seems to have a bit of pedigree behind him. I think he was at Santos, and I think Nishimura's out injured, and Foginho's been out injured recently for Sendai, and they've picked up a bit recently. I think they've only one loss in the last 7, but quite a few draws there. They're fighting for their lives. They really need Cardoso to come good, and they really need everything that they can get. I only saw the highlights of this game, but like as you say, that the first 30 minutes was all like Sapporo scoring or having goals ruled out for offside. And then Sendai went up and did this. And it felt like from what I saw in the highlights, it was like being 1-1 after all the attacking that Sapporo had done. It was a gut punch. It knocked the stuffing out of them. And then from then on, it was a bit quieter, or as I think you might come on to, Sendai might have had a chance to go ahead and win it.
Well, yeah, I'd better come back to you for the next one, the next VAR incident, Johnny, because it does involve Akito Fukumori, and we know that, he can do no wrong in Sam's eyes. So, 10 minutes into the second half, Masai thought he'd won Sendai a penalty when the previously mentioned Akito Fukumori slid in to block his shot with his arm raised. The ball did appear to make contact with Fukumori's arm, and Sendai must have thought they were on when the referee was called over to the monitor. But no dice, Johnny. After a 2.5-minute delay, the referee, Mr. Nishimura's original decision of a corner stood. This was a real head-scratcher, as I can't remember too many other instances when a referee has been summoned over to the monitor and then not overturned his original decision.
Yeah, there's not much I can say about this one. I'm no fan of penalties for accidental handballs in the box, but Fukumori has slid in his hands away from the body. If the ball gets past him, it's a very good chance in the six-yard box for Sendai. And the fact that then that the referee is called over to the box, I'd love to hear his explanation. Like, how has he looked at that and thought, no, that's not a penalty to Sendai? I've got nothing. I mean, Sam, you're a big fan of Fukumori. Is there anything you can say in his defence?
I don't know. He's got some sort of hold over them. Mr. Nishimura likes him as much as I do, and just like, whatever, I'm going to give him. I was just baffled at this point. I mean, he's dived across. It's a going towards goal. It's whether it's, I don't know what silhouettes are when you're diving across, but it seemed raised. It just hit his arm. There was no question about it. I was looking at it, and he was just, when he was making this, what have you seen? It's definitely hit his hand. It's going towards goal. Like, it's a no-brainer. You've been called over, which is basically code for, you've got this wrong, have a look, and then change your mind. And it's just, it just says, no, I'm not being swayed by you. I'm keeping my decision. I thought it was just another disgusted decision. Again, I'm lost for words. I don't know what he was watching. And, yeah, Fukumori's got very lucky.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, yeah, I don't know what got into to Massey. I don't know what he had for breakfast. But, yeah, after he'd scored his first J1 goal to equalise, he then, as we said, crossed from the byline for, Fukumori to handle. And then shortly after, he blasted against the bar from inside the six-yard box after Takanori Sugano had pushed out Takuma Nishimura's shot. So, the right-back Massey, all of a sudden he was playing like a Kylian Mbappe for France and PSG. He had an absolute stormer of a game. Unfortunately, though, for Sendai, yes, his shot went against the bar and came back into play. And up the other end, Takuro Kaneko shot through traffic with Jakub Slovic's left-hand post coming to Sendai's rescue. Then the big pole saved superbly from Chanatip's fierce drive, and ultimately it ended 1-1. A game with so many talking points, and Nishimura and the VAR need to just sort themselves out. I think this was a dreadful display, and it did give us an enormous amount to talk about. And with that game wrapped up, that was This Week in VAR. And that brings us to the final game of the match day, and it's actually the one that had the most goals in it. At the Pokhari Sweat Stadium, a rip-roaring start saw a visiting Shimizu go 2-1 up over host Tokushima inside the first 20 minutes. Teruki Hara guided a terrific volley through traffic to give S-Pulse a second-minute lead, but his goal was topped by a brilliant 25-yard Masaki Watai strike in the 14th minute that drew Vortis level. Parity lasted only 5 minutes, though, as Tokushima's own goal curse struck for the third straight game. This time, Naoto Kami Fukumoto pushed Hara's fierce drive out, but off his defender Kaka's face and into the net. S-Pulse kept their hosts at arm's length for most of the second half, but late on, the Vortis substitute Yudai Konishi let fly from inside the D, the ball deflecting off a defender and flashing into the net past a wrong-footed Shuichi Gonda. So I guess this was the closest thing we had to a relegation six-pointer on the slate this weekend. Johnny with Shimizu 13th and Tokushima 15th at kickoff. And they served up some entertaining fare at times, as I said, after a very entertaining start, at least. But ultimately, I suppose, Tokushima, I guess, have steadied their ship somewhat. S-Pulse will be very frustrated to let the 3 points slip right at the death.
I actually wanted to watch the Kashiwa-Kashima game yesterday, but I had a plan at 8 o'clock, so I was left a choice between this game and the Hiroshima one. And in my head, I thought this has got 0-0 written all over it, so that there's another horrible prediction for me, because it looked like quite an entertaining game. Because Tokushima, like you said, 3 own goals in 3 games from very similar circumstances. You want to say it's horrible luck, but you know, like in Scotland, people always say, like, the Old Firm always get penalties easily, or, like, I'm sure Sam knows, like, in England, people always say, oh, it's another penalty to Man United. But when you kind of analyse it, those teams always have the ball in the opposition box. I wonder if it's, like, Tokushima sort of like passing it around at the back, and then other teams often have the ball in their box. It's maybe that the more often the ball's in their box, the more likely like they are to concede that kind of goal. And I noticed another point they had, is it young Taiyo Nishino, is an 18-year-old with his first J1 start. He was starting up front ahead of Kakita, who's gone a bit inconsistent. And then it seems that only really Miyashiro has been contributing up front. Like, Watai scored a goal in this game. I think it's his first in J1, but he's not really done as well as I thought he would do. And yeah, I think we didn't mention earlier, but like Danny Poyatos, the coach, he's gone back to, I think it's been announced today, he's gone back to Spain for personal reasons. Whether he comes back, we're not sure, because that's, you said Tokushima have steadied the ship, but they've only won once in 12 games. As I mentioned earlier, they're 6 points ahead of Gamba, but they've played 7 games extra. So Gamba win against Fukuoka, they're really feeling the pressure. I'd say at the moment it's a toss-up between them and Oita, who is the second weakest team in the league after Yokohama FC. They need to change something or they're going to be back in J2 next season. But I mean, if I was to say one positive thing, that because Poyatis has come in, and obviously, Sam, you've criticised him a bit about kind of taking them backwards, but random start of the week, Yudai Kunishi's goal, that's the first goal or assist by a Tokushima player, Tokushima substitute this year, so he's had some kind of positive effect. But yeah, Sam, what do you make of this news about Poyatos going back to Spain? Do you think we will see him back in the Tokushima dugout?
Well, we don't know exactly what the personal reasons are, and I mean, going into an Olympic break, it is the perfect time to go back, and you can spend a couple of weeks there and then be back with the team in time for the resumption of the fixtures. But it would not surprise me in the slightest if he doesn't return. I don't think it's worked out for him. I have been very critical of the way that they've played. I didn't get to see this game, just the highlights, and it was glorious to me to see Masaki Watai actually play in the number 10 position for once, and it seemed to work. But yeah, it's just that there's a reason. You mentioned Kakita hasn't really looked like he's been up to much in recent games, but I mean, he's been on his own up front, and they just waiting for the ball to come to him while he just plays head tennis, watching the ball get passed sideways behind him. I mean, yeah, he's not really had much to feed off, and at least in this game, it seems as if they were going forward a little bit with a bit more urgency, a little bit more direct. They were keen to take shots from the edge of the area, which again has not happened this season. They've not been willing to kind of take a risk at all. It was always, okay, we'll just work our way in slowly, 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 and eventually get towards the goal. And so that was fairly good to see. I mean, defensively, like, this is the third game in a row where one player has hit it off their teammate and into the goal. I mean, what are you doing? I mean, yeah, once is unfortunate. Second, oh yeah, okay, maybe it's a little unlucky, but how many more times? I mean, and that's before the game before, I mean, Kaka played in, I can't remember who it was, for Tokyo to score. So it's just consistent errors at the back and just kind of erratic play in their clearances. And considering how measured they are in everything else when they have possession, it's very weird that you have to panic as soon as you are in your own 18-yard box. So, yeah, I mean, there is a lot to work on. It's if Poyatos is to stay, this is the worst time to go, because you'd expect, oh, we've got a month here, we can really work on this, we can nail down exactly how Poyatos wants to play, but he's not going to be there. I mean, it did work on Zoom earlier in the season, so maybe he can just stay there on the computer and it'll all work out for Tokushima. But yeah, I think I think if he is to leave, he needs to make that decision, or someone has to make that decision quickly, because it does nobody any good to be in limbo for a month, not really knowing what's happening when you Tokushima are firmly in this relegation zone. And I still think, yeah, a 2-2 draw is pretty decent, but it's not going to be enough, I don't think, the way they are sliding towards that drop zone, especially when you imagine Gamba are going to get enough points to overtake them over these coming weeks.
Yeah, most definitely. All right. Yeah, well said, Sam. And that's a great pickup there, Johnny. And as you say, that's something we could have mentioned back in part one in the housekeeping section. And obviously, in other managerial news, of course, Tokushima, yeah, as we said, they don't play over the Olympic break, but Tosu have two games, one each on the next two weekends. And, yeah, news has come out that their coach, Kim, has been suspended by the club. Now, I don't have all the details to hand, and guys, I'm not sure how confident you are in the information that you have either. But yes, we do believe that Kim has been suspended by the club for his for his conduct, perhaps at training. Again, you can fill the listeners in on what you know. At least for the two games over the Olympic break and for the first game back after the league resumes in early August, Kim will not be in the Tosu dugout, Johnny.
Yeah, I think what I saw was, I think, Sam, you were talking on Twitter, and I believe it was Naoya, the Kawasaki fan, had sort of translated. He has much better Japanese than I do. We're obviously slightly walking on eggshells as we don't know exactly what's happened, but I think when we're kind of discussing earlier, we're not sure, like, three-game ban versus dismissal, like, where is the cutoff point? We don't really know. I mean, the two things I wrote down about the incident, has Kim lost the respect of the players through what's happened? And also, Tosu have a very good, like, youth system, as we've seen this year, and there's a lot of players in, like junior high and high school coming through. And obviously, to keep recruiting young players, you not only have to get them on board with opportunities, you have to get the parents on board. So incidents like this, if they're not handled correctly, can have a knock-on effect for years to come. Without really knowing the situation, I think that's all I really feel comfortable saying. I don't know, Sam, do you know any more than that?
No, it's an interesting point you make about what the sort of relationship he now has with the players, because this was Tosu put a timeline of how they came to the decision. It was a week-long investigation, and their 40 playing members were all interviewed individually to get to this. So it's obviously, we don't really know what's happened. Let's just say training ground incident at this moment. But yeah, if after the course of that, they've come to the decision that the manager needs to be suspended, and especially for three games where it's not really helping the team at all to have no manager in charge for training and three crucial games. So, it is interesting. It brings up kind of shades of Chokwi Jay and his kind of power harassment affair at Shonan a couple of years ago. And it seems, again, speculating, but it seems on very similar lines to that. So I wonder if there is a further investigation going on while he's suspended. And, will they then come to a decision where they do just terminate his contract? Or is there some sort of olive branch that can be offered out? They can reconcile, they can get the players back on board. But yeah, it's a very interesting scenario at Sagan Tosu. And it's a real shame because he has done such a good job with that team just to build that young 11. It's been so good to watch this season. They're still in with the chance of the ACL. So you really hope that an issue in training has not derailed them at all, and hopefully they can all get past it, and whatever he did wasn't too serious, and that the relationship is broken beyond all repair.
Yes, it looks like a developing story, but Tosu will have to do without their coach for, as you said, their two games over the Olympic break, and indeed the first one after the league resumes. Indeed, if Kim is back in the Tosu dugout at all, we will have to wait and see. It has been such a great start to the season for Tosu, although they have slid down the table while the ACL clubs have been away. Interestingly enough, Tosu have hardly been in action, and they've been overtaken by Urawa and Kobe in the meantime. All right, so that is it then for match day 22, but obviously with the schedule so messed up for so many reasons through the first few months of the season, there's actually only six teams that have played 22 games thus far. We've officially reached the Olympic break, but as we've mentioned throughout this episode, the catch-up for the four ACL clubs begins this Saturday with the four games taking place, highlighted, I guess for some, by a Kansai derby with the Cerezo Osaka hosting Kobe, and Tosu, who will be without Kim, they're entertaining Nagoya. Champions Kawasaki travel to Shimizu, and Gamba, as we've mentioned, who's the season was, of course, derailed before it really got going after their COVID outbreak, begin a grueling run of eight games in 23 days that runs up to the resumption of the league after the break. So, Johnny, what are you planning to do for, during the course of this this run of games for your blog? If you wanted to do a preview and a review of every single game, you wouldn't be getting much sleep over the course of the next 3 weeks. So how are you going to handle things on the Gumba Osaka blog in English?
I'll probably be continuing what I've been doing and kind of putting like predicted lineups and some stats up before games, like a day or two before. But yeah, like this year I've kind of taken a step back because I don't have the time to do a full preview or review every day essentially. But yeah, I'm hoping to get to the Kashima game, the home game on the 24th. I think tickets go on sale on Wednesday. There's only 5,000 people allowed, so I don't know if I'll quite make it to that one, but at least when the games were in Uzbekistan, they were very late at night, but I'm generally in my house between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. In terms of, like, since COVID started, I think 7 p.m. Wednesday night kickoffs can do one as far as I'm concerned, because I usually end up having to watch them at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. But if Gamba win, I'll be more than happy to deal with this spell, if at least we pick up some points. If we go back to nil-nils all the time, I'm probably going to enjoy it a bit less.
Yeah, I reckon. So, yeah, I mean, shades of a 2020 here for Gumba, Johnny, as you basically play weekend midweek for the next 4 weeks, right? So it's the next 3 weeks, rather. Yeah, it's going to be hugely taxing on the players. But, yeah, we do wish you all the best for that. Well, wish you and your team, rather, all the best for that that run of games. And, yeah, once again, thank you ever so much for your time on this episode. Always great to have you on to get your thoughts on the, all of J1. And, we look forward to doing so again very soon.
Thanks again for having me. I think this is the first time I've been on with This Week in VAR, so that's a milestone for me. And there's been tons of things to go through, like transfers, managers, games, incidents. So, yeah, it's been a long episode. I hope people enjoy listening to it and stay with it to the end.
All right, terrific stuff. Thanks again, Johnny. And to Sam, well, you've done a pair of work today, mate, and the fact that you fronted up at all is a huge credit to yourself. Great to catch up. Great to hear you had such a great time at Wembley on Sunday. Of course, we're all disappointed it didn't end better for England. Well, of course, the Italians listening aren't, but sorry for yourself and commiserations on that. But another bumper episode. And next week we'll get ourselves ready for the Olympics.
Yeah, I think all people being upset for me, I think that's a bit of a stretch. I think if you're not English, you weren't supporting England yesterday. But yeah, it's been good to just get, just 2 hours of not talking about it too much and getting past it. So yeah, I really look forward to the Olympics. I think the Japan, especially the men's team, I will get to know the women's team over the course of the month or so. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to the men's chances. I think they've got a really exciting squad. So yeah, looking forward to diving into those teams next week.
Brilliant stuff. All right, well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Johnny Nicol for his time on this episode. We'd like to thank all of our patrons for their support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, as always, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up the 4 J1 games and look ahead to the Olympic football tournaments. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.